You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
We're all looking for ways to save, especially on medical bills. But where do you start? Unless you're a medical bill expert, finding savings can seem impossible. Well, HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a healthcare technology company that securely connects with your insurance and flags errors like overbilling, wrong codes, and fraud. You can even have HealthLock work on your behalf to get money back from select past bills. So start saving with knowing where to look. Visit HealthLock.com today before you see another healthcare provider. That's HealthLock.com.
Hi, hello, this is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host, Liv, who's trying to think of something quippy to say, but doesn't have anything. So today's episode, as promised, is the New Year Q&A episode. I have been asking you all to ask me questions, provide me with suggestions of topics, really any and everything, and you all delivered, because you're lovely. Now, today, I've been looking at the questions, and it looks like I have enough to split this into two episodes, which frankly is also just good for me for selfish purposes, in that basically everything in my life exploded in December in a way that is just, I mean, literally the end of 2024 has probably been the worst year of my life in terms of just volume and extensivity of personal tragedy and trauma and stress, and oh my god, it's just been a time. And that is all to say, I'm really lucky that I about 6 months ago planned a trip away from my home in January, but it does mean I had to prepare some episodes in advance. Now I'm just rambling, but basically I could not write a script in the last week because usually I just end up crying. So I'm just gonna answer your questions over two episodes, and thank you all. Basically, you've helped me immensely, because yep, it's been a time, but thankfully I have the distraction of all of your incredible questions. You asked some really fun ones. Somewhere, I forget which one this was. I'm sure it'll come up when I get to it, but I just remember reading it come in through my email, and I was like, oh, I am so glad someone asked that. Like, so often you guys ask me things that I would love to talk about, but they just don't easily come up naturally in an episode. It is why I love Q&A episodes. It's why my Patreon, when it is usually running, is also filled with bonus Q&A episodes, because it presents new ways of thinking about these topics, new ideas, new answers that come to me when reading your questions. It really brings up so many new concepts and thoughts that I personally find them to be so beneficial. And I keep hearing from you all that you do too. So that I get to do these kind of now twice a year is really lovely. It really helps me. And it's just kind of a joy. So without any further rambling before I get into what is just going to be an episode full of unscripted rambling, let's just dive right in. This is episode 243, digging deeper into minor gods, exploring modern Greece, and praising Dionysus. A New Year Q&A, part 1. All right, I had such a wonderful number of questions from all of you, so I'm just kind of scrolling through, picking some stuff at random, and we are going to dive right in. Let's start with something quick and fun. This one comes from Nicole Tony, who says, "What is your fave Euripides play?" And also fave translation. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. The thing about me picking favorites of anything, and this comes up with like literally everything in my life, but a lot really specifically to do with Greek mythology, is that my favorite depends on what kind of mood I'm in, you know? Like, basically, I have, I would say, 4 favorite plays of Euripides. It's Bacchae when I just feel like reading about somebody fucking shit up. It's Medea when I want to feel righteously, furiously angry. It's Alcestis when I want something silly and weird. And it is the Helen when I want God's whatever incredible mess the Helen is. It's just like there's so much to Euripides, and his plays are just so wide and varied in terms of their theme and even just like the mood generally, that it just totally depends. But I mean, all of them are wonderful because Euripides is a fucking king among men. But fave translations, it really depends. I often read Anne Carson's translations. They're really readable, really poetic, but also she kind of keeps her translations simple, I would say, and to the point. So they're really interesting translations for sure. And then I have this other book called The Greek Plays, which is like a really big compendium. If you're looking to just pick up a translation of all 3 of the tragedians, this is a great place to start, because it's really huge. I think there's like 3 or 4 plays from each of them. And there's a lot of women translators in there, including some by Emily Wilson. And I really enjoy those ones of the ones that I have read. I'm forgetting which translator translated the Euripides ones in there, but I remember definitely enjoying them. And then let's go straight into something wild. This one comes from somebody who I note actually did not put their name, just pronouns. So she says, "In myth, there is a lot of incest. Kings marry their daughters to their sons or cousins to cousins. The gods are all related in some ways, so there's a lot of procreation amongst siblings. However, in Oedipus, the marriage and children between himself and his mother is taboo. Was parent-child incest specifically not accepted in society? Did any Greek gods have relationships that were parent-child?" I love this question because, like, the Greek mythology is so fucked up. And I love that we're just going to dive straight into it. So I will say, like, I don't know the explicit rules when it comes to Greek society, but I can make very educated guesses and assumptions. And in that, I would say that the gods are gods, I think, is the biggest thing to remember. The gods are gods. They are not humans. And so I don't think that any of the relationships between the gods in terms of incest would be considered even remotely okay amongst humans. I think that's a really specific distinction. And it comes from probably a lot of different places, but the primary one being that, like, if you're developing a world of gods where everyone, you know, has to kind of come from somewhere, there are just going to be these inevitable relationships, particularly when you're looking at people like the Olympians, like, the Olympians are meant to be the most important, the most powerful. And so, like, they just kind of inherently have to be related, and you just kind of inherently have to be okay with them then marrying. That said, I don't think that there are any parent-child relationships. I think that that definitely, like, on so many levels would be too far, even for the gods, which I think is why Oedipus and Jocasta is the main issue. But at the same time, the big issue with Oedipus and Jocasta is also that, one, that they had children, I think, because that kind of adds this, like, a different criminal aspect, but also that he killed his father to get to that position. Like, there's a lot of different things coming into play in that play that make it really distinctly bad. But that said, yeah, like, I don't think, I mean, I imagine cousins married, because, like, that's just the way it was for a really long time, you know, like, really recently that was a thing. So I would say, you know, you can kind of ignore the whole cousin aspect, but in terms of closer relations, I don't think that that was common or acceptable in general Greek society. And the gods really are just a different situation entirely, out of so many different reasons, but the big one just being that they were divine, you know, and they kind of just didn't fall into the same categories. But I really truly love that you asked this question. Like, my favorite part about talking about Greek mythology is just generally how fucked up it was if you look at it through any kind of, like, critical lens, and just kind of consider that, like, this is just what was happening in the general belief structure of the time. And I think that's incredibly weird and fun, and far more interesting than, you know, I don't know, than if they weren't all fucking related and weird. All right, this one is from Kyla, who says, oh, has two-part question. One, I notice that the translations you read often use the word car. Did car have a meaning before the modern engine, or is it to draw an image for their audience, like the use of the word corn? And I'm so glad that you brought up both of those words, because it's something that I've been wanting to talk about on the show, but needed a better opportunity. So the word car has existed long, long, long before what we think of as cars. It's just coming from more old and ancient notions of, like, carts, vehicles of any kind. You know, it seems like, according to Wikipedia, because I did look this up for etymological reasons, and it looks like the word in English probably or might come from the Latin word carus or carum, which just meant wheeled vehicle, it says. Or even there's, like, Middle English that's car, but, like, C-A-R-R-E, and that just meant two-wheeled cart. So we're just talking, like, things with wheels, basically, when you're referring to car. And with corn, it's really interesting. I've been told this from a couple of different people, because obviously I come from North America, where corn is, like, our thing, right? And then the whole thing is that, you know, what we, at least in North America, consider to be corn, you know, like, popped corn, kind of, why is that the only one I can think of? Anyway, that kind of corn is not the general consensus on the word corn. And so in beyond North America, it seems to have just generally meant, like, grain. So the word can be used to refer to cereals, grains, any kind of, like, that type of crop, like, well beyond what we in North America consider to be corn. I had originally thought it was more like a mistranslation, but no, it's just, like, a different usage of the word. I mean, I find this stuff so interesting because, like, I'm obviously very North American, and while I'm Canadian and we use, you know, we have Canadian English, which is a lot closer to British English than it is to American English, but it's really something weirdly in between. You know, like, I am still defined by North America, and it's just an interesting thing. I am often disappointed that I am defined by North America, because I think North America in its current colonial structure is a fucking disaster and weirdly insular and absolutely cultureless, besides everything that we stole. And, you know, I love hearing from the world beyond North America and figuring out the things that I don't know because of where I came from. So I'm really glad you asked that, because I think it's just generally really fucking interesting. And the second question by Kyla is, if Kronos was the time deity and the grain/farming association came from the Roman Saturn, was Kronos the Titan of anything? And that was, sorry, two different spellings of Kronos, which I will get into in my response. Because, yeah, so Kronos, C-H, was a time deity. And then Kronos with a K in the Greek, but often spelled with a C, but no H, is, you know, the Titan, the father of Zeus and his lot. And he is the one associated with the Roman Saturn in a way. Roman gods are really interesting because while they have a lot of close associations with some Greek gods, they're often really, really different. Like Saturn was a much more important and widely worshipped god than Kronos was. Kronos was like, not as far as I understand Kronos in Greek mythology, and I am talking about the Titan Kronos, he wasn't really a god that people like still thought of. You know, he was a historical god, right? He was like the one who came before Zeus, but humans worship Zeus. And he had been overthrown and all this stuff. So like, I don't think anyone went out there and like worshipped Kronos, whereas in Rome it's just like a totally different situation because it's coming from a very different place. You know, they are kind of taking on and adapting certain things about Greek mythology in some cases, but they're completely making them their own. And Saturn is a really, really good example of a god that has these Greek origins ish you know, but also is like completely distinct from Greek. Now Kronos the Greek, again, the Titan, he did have the symbol of the sickle, right? But it wasn't a sickle like that he was using in farming. It was a sickle that he used to, you know, castrate his father, Uranus, right? Like that kind of sickle, you know? And so I imagine that that sort of eventually lent itself to grain and farming associations because obviously it is a farming tool. So I don't know the Saturn bit well enough to say confidently because I just don't know enough about when those Roman gods like were so distinct from the Greek. But I would imagine that that kind of just became a natural association. And then Kronos, the god of time, is really interesting because he really only shows up in Orphic mythology. He really does not get included in any in anything beyond Orphic. You know, he might have been sort of mentioned here and there, I think. But even if you look into him, like, he's very specifically called an Orphic deity. But I think then, you know, he is associated with time. He is where we get the word chronology. Now, all of that said, I just read further down on Theoi's page on him. And it does look like, I mean, I don't know. So they say here that outside of the Orphic tradition, Kronos with a CH is connected with Kronos, the Titan. They say that very clearly, but I don't actually see what they're talking about because it says that they're usually identical. See Pindar below. But then Pindar doesn't seem to say that. Like, he literally just says, he just references Kronos with a CH. Or just with an H is the key, because when it's in Greek, it's still a K, but it's KH. It's very confusing when you're talking English. But yeah, I still think that he is a different kind of god, but I would imagine that Kronos with an H is more like a personification god, right? One of those diamond gods, because I never know how to say it, demon or daimon. Anyway, because he is just sort of he is time. He is a personification of time. And so I think that eventually these things just kind of get pushed together. You know, he is time. So sometimes you'll even just see him be called time in a translation because it literally means time, right? It's like, you know, Nike, victory, is going to come up later. She is another example of that, where often in translations, it will just say victory. Because the word, the name is the word, right? We think of it as a name now because the name is Nike or Kronos with a K, but it just means victory and time. Because these things just symbolized a concept, you know, in as just as much as they also symbolized like an actual deity. So I imagine this sort of all eventually just kind of came together because you're talking these two gods that have such similar names, and they're even more similar once they are, you know, transliterated into Latin and English, because, you know, in Greek there is no letter C, right? There's just a K, or there's a kappa, or there's a chi, which is looks like CH when we write it in English, but it really looks like an X in English. I mean, there's a lot going on here. We're trying to like explain Greek letters and etymology all in one place. But like, I imagine it just sort of is a later conflation. Also, because for a long time, most of what we had from ancient Greece actually came to us through Latin. Like, Latin was the dominant language for so long that a lot of times, like, that's why you'll often see these translations of even like Homer, where Latin names are used, right? Where it's like, it's Homer, but Odysseus is Ulysses, but it's Homer. And that's because we had Homer in Latin, which then got translated into English, but it was Latin from the Greek. And so, like, there's just these different layers that were happening in between for a really long time before people started translating, I think, direct from Greek. And so, you know, there's just a lot of kind of things happening there. But I imagine that's how the two chronoses ended up becoming one and becoming so linked to the Latin chronos, or the Latin Saturn, rather, because, like, we've got these obvious connections and Latin just became the more important one. And I mean, there's honestly so much there. And I would love to speak to a scholar who can talk more about, you know, this like Greek Latin divide and everything that kind of happened there historically. Like, and I'm talking well beyond the ancient world, because what I find interesting is, like, so much happened after the fact. So much happened just in terms of like the last 1,000 years in terms of what we had access to and could translate, and how that affected how we see kind of everything, certainly as, you know, modern, and I'm saying English speaking people, because that's what was so influenced by Latin. Honestly, it's fascinating. Thank you for that question, Kyla. Okay, next one, because I'm going to try to get through a ton. What am I doing? It's already been 20 minutes. This next one is from Maguire Trotz, who says, and this is a great one, "Do you think that perhaps one of the reasons that Euripides is so great is that he was gay? I like to think so." I like to think so, too. So I definitely think, I think that there is something going on with Euripides. I think him being gay is a very, very convincing argument. I also had a guest on, I believe it was Julie Levy, who theorized that Euripides was trans. I forget if their theory was that, I imagine it, like a closeted trans woman. I mean, it's really difficult to say, obviously, because there was so much happening there that we can't translate into modern notions. But I do think that certainly Euripides was queer in some way. I just think there's so much going on, because I think trans is probably a really convincing argument, even if just we're looking at the fact that Euripides was so interested in the lives of women. And I just think that that really lends itself to this idea that, like, maybe, you know, even if he didn't know that he was trans, like, maybe he had these inklings, you know, these feelings of, like, you know, I feel more comfortable with women. I associate more with women. I have more in common with them. Like, whatever it was, like, I do think that there's something going on with Euripides that really lent itself to why his work and his treatment of women is so unique. I think that's a great theory. I definitely think that he was queer in some way, even if it's just sort of this kind of amorphous notion, because it's really impossible to put these modern ideas onto someone who would have no idea what the fuck we're talking about, right? Because it just wasn't acceptable. It wasn't done, but it wasn't even so much not unacceptable as it was just, like, not thought of, you know. Like, I think it's best to think about the Greeks as just sort of not thinking about sexuality in that way at all. They considered it to be the right thing for men to marry a woman, but that is in large part coming from procreation, right? And so it just became the natural order. But at the same time, there was an entire tradition of having romantic and sexual relationships between men. You know, a lot of that is pederasty. So there's a lot going on in terms of, you know, age and consent and a lot of questions that, you know, I won't get into right now, but are very important to consider when we're talking about this. But at the same time, we have to remember that it was absolutely acceptable for men to be in relationships with other men. It's just that they never married, but it wasn't like they weren't, you know, they weren't allowed by society. It was simply just like not thought of. It was never conceptualized because it was simply a matter of, yeah, you had this romantic sexual relationship with this man. You absolutely loved him, but you had to marry a woman because procreation. Like, it just wasn't about. It wasn't about right and wrong in my head. Again, this is me theorizing. But in my head, it wasn't so much about right and wrong as it was about just like the physical nature of the world. And so they just didn't consider it in that way because they were able to maintain these romantic relationships. So it's not like a man was like not allowed. If he was in love with another man, he wasn't not allowed to see him. He wasn't not allowed to have sex with him. He wasn't even not allowed to like openly have some kind of romantic entanglement. It's just that, like, the actual physical act of marriage was so inherently tied to creating a baby that it just didn't mesh up. Like, marriage was not about romance. It was about procreation and creating this, like, family structure, you know? Anyway, it's really interesting. But at the same time, like, because all of our notions, certainly as English speakers and from the West, all of our notions are so inherently tied to Christianity as much as we might not want them to be. Like, I'm not remotely fucking Christian, but I was raised with Christmas, you know, like it. So even I am coming at it from this way where I don't believe anything from Christianity, but I have grown up in this structure that means that like all of my notions are still tied to Christianity when the Greeks were before that, just long before. And so they didn't have any of those same hangups or ties or notions. And so it's just kind of almost impossible to theorize, or it's impossible to know with any kind of certainty. But theorizing is really interesting. Oh my gosh, I clearly could talk about that forever, but it's absolutely fascinating. I'm going to move on. This next question is from Brie, and they asked, will you be covering myths featuring the Hyperboreans with acknowledgement of the misuse of them by the far right? Thank you, Brie. You almost inspired me to try this in January, and then I kept opening files and crying instead. So not right now, but soon enough, yes. I would love to talk about Hyperboreans. The thing about the fucking Hyperboreans is that, like, there's no stories, you know? There's just, like, this amorphous concept of, like, these people who lived in the North and then were apparently like fancy and divine in some way. And then of course, yeah, far right white supremacists locked onto them in the same ways that they locked onto Atlantis. But like, again, like the Hyperboreans are at least more mythical than Atlantis because mythographers talked about them, but there's not like a lot of stories or there's not like any kind of heavy mythology. There's just like this vague notion of like, well, it's mostly just that they like knew there were people to the North and they were like, ooh, you're living that far. You must be special. Like, it wasn't anything anyway, but one day I will definitely talk about them in more detail. Thank you for asking.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah. Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
All right. This one, I'm just going to say, because some of you might have been wondering about it. Mel asked me, tell us about the Crown of Starlight controversy. And I won't. I will let you Google what you need to Google, because what you might not have known in asking about this is that I was friends with the author of Crown of Starlight, and that fucking mess and utter bullshit was definitely a large part of what made the last 4 months of my life fucking shit. So you can go ahead and Google. It was awful, and I am no longer friends with them, and absolutely think it was fucking... Anyway, yeah, I'm just gonna fucking step back, but the book is not existing anymore, so we don't have to worry. It's been a time. Okay, next one is from Maria Ignacia, who says, what's a value or principle represented in myth that you think we should bring back? And I'm going to tell you, I don't think I have a satisfying answer for this. Instead, what I'm going to say is that, like, I don't know. Like, it's funny because I am a person who is really, really passionate about right and wrong and humanity and the sanctity of human life for everyone, no matter where they live or where they were born or what people associated with them might have done. And so, you know, I feel really strongly about this stuff, so much that it absolutely takes over my ability to live a happy life. But at the same time, like, I don't look to the ancients for that. I can't name a single value or principle, like, from myth that I even really consider a value or principle, let alone that I think should be brought back. Because I also think, and I, to be clear, I do not think that this was your intention, Maria, and I am not coming for you whatsoever with this. But I do think that this notion is often used as a way to glorify the ancient Greeks specifically, you know, it kind of gets tied to this notion that they were smarter, better, more interesting, more impressive than other ancient people who we have not so distinctly connected to the construct of Western civilization. And so, like, as a result, the Greeks get put on this pedestal as if they were so much better, and then that inherently gets tied to the West being so much better, which is obviously just so problematic. Like, there were so many other ancient people doing absolutely the same level of wonderful things as the ancient Greeks, all at the same time, in the same region, further, you know, in all other parts of the world. And they don't get enough attention. And, like, obviously I'm perpetuating that by talking about Greece, but it's just that's who I'm interested in, that's who I love. But I also want to make sure that I am using my platform to, like, point out that these issues. But I mean, even aside from that, I just, like, don't really think in values and principles. Like, I just go to, like, what feels to be, like, so obviously right and wrong, and so I just don't kind of have any connection to that in mythology specifically. But I do think it's a really interesting question. I don't think there's anything wrong with seeing it that way, as long as you kind of are aware of, like, you know, kind of what else exists in that sort of realm of thought. I just personally just don't think about that at all. I just think of the Greek myths as, like, this fascinating look at how ancient people told stories and thought and what they might have believed, but I just don't connect it to the modern world in that way. I don't know. My brain's weird also. I don't tend to think in the same ways as a lot of people want me to, and I'm perpetually sorry that I can't answer your questions better. All right, this next one is from Cole, and they said, I know you are vehement about Pegasus being an individual, not a species. I also think I recall you mentioning that the Chimera is your favorite mythical monster, or at the very least, one you enjoy a lot. With those statements in mind, does it bother you that the word Chimera has sort of changed from being the monster's name to being a sort of catch-all term for hybrid monsters? If not, why does that bother you? But Pegasus does. If you know, my ADHD brain doesn't always know why things do or don't bother me, so I understand if you aren't able to verbalize it. Oh, I am able to verbalize it, Cole. I am thrilled that you asked this question. All right, and here is my reasoning. So this is probably not entirely historically and etymologically valid reasoning. I'll say that up front. This is a my brain reasoning, and it is this. Pegasus is a name, like a proper, like a name, like his given name. It's, you know, it's not the same. He didn't have a parent name him, but, like, it is his given name, you know? Whereas the Chimera, to me, feels more like just the name given to a creature by the people, you know, coming upon that creature. In the same way, like, the Nemean lion or the Hydra. And so, and again, I think that this is mythologically accurate? Maybe not. But in my head, this is why. And also, the difference comes in the ways that the names have been changed. So I like the idea that a chimera means a kind of, you know, amalgam of creatures, because that's interesting. And also because the chimera was so fucking weird that that just fits so perfectly, right? Lion, goat, snake, like, it becoming this meaning of, like, an amalgamated creature, that's interesting. Whereas what I don't like about Pegasus becoming this name for flying horses is that, like, the term flying horses is far more descriptive of a flying horse than Pegasus. You know, Pegasus is literally his name. And so, just to me, like, and again, this is ADHD brain, like, they're just not the same. And I probably don't need to explain further, but that is where my brain goes. And I really appreciate you letting me break that down in my own brain and put it into words. Do I think you're wrong for questioning why I have differing answers to both? Not at all. But those are my answers. All right. Next one comes from Ryan. And I don't know anything about you, Ryan, but your name is spelled interestingly. And if you're dad is named Tim. We've got some weird things to talk about. If any lost Greek, this is Ryan's question. I'm just making it weird. If any lost Greek play/myth was suddenly discovered, is there anyone you would love it to be? Oh my God. Yes. Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. You know, there are so many. And again, it's like my answer about my favorite Euripides play. Like, it totally depends on all these different kind of factors. But I'm going to go with my first thought, which is that Euripides wrote a play called The Cadmus. And I desperately want to know how much Cadmus it was about. If it was about him at the time of, you know, the Bacchae, I don't give a fuck, because that's after all of the things I'm interested in. If it is about a young Cadmus, then I want it more than anything. He also, though, had plays about Bellerophon, which I think would be really interesting, because Bellerophon is so, like, underspoken of, speaking of the Chimera. And there are probably so many more, but I'm going to actively not look at a list so that I don't have any more answers, because truly I just want them all. All right. This next one is from Serena, who just says, do you sell signed copies of your book through your website or Monroe's still? Thank you for asking, Serena. Yes, I do. So if any of you are looking to get a signed copy of either of my books, The Cocktails, Nectar of the Gods, or my little Greek mythology book, yes, if you want a signed copy, you can still go to Monroe's. I don't think that they always have me sign their stock now, because they probably think it bothers me, and I don't blame them. It doesn't, but, you know, I don't want to bug them either. But if you want a signed copy, all you have to do is, like, put a note in when you order it that you want it signed, and if you want it personalized, you can write that there too, and I will happily go sign it. It's really easy for me to go to Monroe's, and I love signing books there. So yes, if you ever need one, I do think it's still listed on my website, but it's monroebooks.com. That's monrobooks.com. It's also a very famous and precious Victoria independent bookstore, so it's really easy to Google if you ever want that as well. And the next one is from Mira, who says, who is your favorite hero and why? Also your opinions on Percy Jackson. Thank you, Mira. Now, okay, first part of your question. My favorite hero is Cadmus, because we don't know enough about him. I find what little we know to be super fucking interesting, and I love him. If you want to know more about why, listen to my episodes on him. He was really cool, but his wife was even cooler. That's Harmonia. The second part of your question, Percy Jackson. I'm sorry, I still don't have opinions on Percy Jackson. I don't. I know I should. I am so grateful to Percy Jackson. I know that those books brought an entire new generation of people to Greek mythology, and I think that's the coolest fucking thing in the world. But to remind you all, sadly, I am old. I think it doesn't come across, which is nice. But I am. When the first Percy Jackson book came out, which, you know, features, like, I think a 10-year-old, I was like 18 or 17. So I just didn't read them. And I also have trouble reading a lot of fiction Greek mythology now, because I just live so much in the mythology that it always feels like work. And so I need my books to kind of be more of an escape. So I actively look for things that have absolutely no Greek mythology, just because that's work. And that's, you know, I love it, love my work. But yeah. So anyway, all to say, I'm sorry, I still don't have opinions. This will come up again on another question, so we'll leave it for now. All right, Candace asks, what would you recommend I go read if I love Dionysus? Aside from the obvious, the Bacchae and the frogs. Thank you. Thank you, Candace. Bacchae is the big one. For sure, it is the best. There's also an ancient text called the Dionysiaca. If you want to read that, it is an epic about the entire life of Dionysus, from all the way, like, to his forefathers. But it is also the longest surviving Greek epic. It is ridiculously fucking long. And also it was written in the 4th century CE. It's like really, really, really late, like from the Christian period, which is like interesting, but also just means it's like, you know, 800 years divorced from even like the Bacchae. 800 years. Sometimes I think we forget how many years are in between some of these sources. So I'll just remind you, 800. It is available to read on theoi.com if you just look up Dionysiaca. Or it's written by a man named Nonus, N-O-N-N-U-S, if you want to Google it. But yeah, like, that's quite a thing if you really want to dive in. I don't think that it's a great portrayal of like a more ancient notion of his mythology, because again, it's 800 years past Bacchae, and Bacchae, you know, is a play, and so Indy is even a few hundred years past most mythology. But it is really interesting. You get some different insights. It's quite, you know, it's written at a time. He's Greek, but I think he was in Alexandria, so he was like living in the Roman Empire, but far from Rome. I don't know, but it has all these really interesting implications when it comes to Rome, because Rome had was like so imperial by then and had like conquered and like colonized so many different lands that like there's this whole section where Dionysus like goes to war with India, which is just really interesting and kind of weird. And like, so it's written at this time when, you know, like India had been discovered by these people. Obviously the people in India were already there. I just mean that the Greeks and the Romans had also come to India and were like, oh my God, you guys are here and you have elephants. That's really cool. So it's from this a really interesting time that's quite late compared to, you know, the Greek period, because before Alexander the Great, the Greeks did not know about India, let alone elephants. So it's quite interesting. It has all these different sort of ramifications, but it is like a very late source. So I wouldn't read it and then be like, I know everything about ancient Greek Dionysus, because that won't be accurate. But it is a really interesting source. And just you should read the Homeric hymn to Dionysus. Trying to think of where his other good stuff is. If you just like look up the name Dionysus in a podcast app and pick my episodes, then I'll have sources that are good. It'll list some more too. Or just Google Theoi, so Theoi and Dionysus. That is the best way to learn fucking anything about any god, by the way, because Theoi.com is a dream. And it's so fucking helpful, but also just like lists all these ancient sources. So if you go there, then it'll have like this list of sources, and then you can go read those sources if you want. But like, it's a good place to be like, here are the sources I would like to read. That's where I even learned about the Dionysiaca existing, because it is a wild fucking ride. The translation of it is tragically not in the public domain, because oh, would I be reading it to you right now if I legally could. All right, this next one is from Alex, and they said, hi, first off, I hope you're doing amazing. Thank you. I love listening to you every morning. It's one of the highlights of my day. More than a question, I just wanted to tell you about an artist, a singer. Now, I don't know what music you enjoy, so I have no idea if you'll like hers, but she wrote an album inspired by the Greek gods. It's called The Gods We Can Touch, and her name is Aurora from Norway. And then, okay, so she Alex talks about this a little bit more, and I just have to tell you, this made me laugh, and like, so I, for the past year, I have been reading, or at the beginning of the year, I started reading a ton of fantasy romance novels, like just so many. And then I started listening to Aurora, like so much Aurora, like literally to the point where my Spotify was like, are you doing okay? Like, she wasn't my number one. That was Florence and the Machine for similar reasons, but like a huge amount. Anyway, I've been listening to that album for like a year, like a lot. And I did not know it was about the Greek gods at all. I know almost every song on that album. I just like didn't listen to the lyrics of it, also like reading while I listen or writing while I listen, so I just don't pay enough attention. But like, I can sing along. But did I know they were about Greek gods? No. So you made me laugh really hard. Thank you very much. That was a joy to learn. And there's a lot of more interesting stuff about Aurora and this album in this question. I can't read it all through, but thank you, Alex. That was a real joy to read and so interesting and just like honestly so fucking funny that like I had no idea and now I have to pay closer attention, because like truly I'm just like, you've included lyrics and everything, and I'm like, I listen to the album so much, it's absurd. That was a joy. Thank you. Okay, this next one is from Mayra. I hope I pronounced that right. Hi, do you think Romans copied Greek mythology into Roman? Do you think Greeks were very angry when they knew about it? By the way, I love your podcast. It totally makes my day. You're amazing. Thank you. That was very kind. And it's a great question. So I've tried to talk about this in like recent episodes, because my opinion on this has changed so much. Because I think the really common misconception, but that I definitely had, like going into this show and just like researching Greek mythology generally, is that the Romans like copied the Greeks. You know, I think people say that a lot. It's a lot of memes. The memes are funny, so it's hard to be annoyed by them. Like that cat one, you know, where the person's drawing the cat and it's like, there's a real cat and that's Greek mythology. Then there's like a really shitty drawing of a cat and that's Roman mythology. Like, that's a great meme. But at the same time, it's just not true. So what happened? I went into this in a recent episode from August, I forget which episode, but it's something in August because that's when I talked about Rome. I think it would be pretty clear if you look back just to August 2023 episodes and take a listen, because I definitely talked about this in greater detail in a way that I can't in this episode. But it's a common misconception because of all of the things that I talked about earlier when I was talking about how, you know, Latin was the dominant language. And so a lot of the Greek sources that we had for a long time came from Latin translations first rather than their original Greek. And because of that, we get this idea of the Roman gods being the same as the Greek gods. Like, we get this notion, you know, that Jupiter was Zeus and Juno was Hera. And, you know, I'm just trying to think of all the examples. Like, Apollo's a bad one because it's literally the same name. But Diana was Artemis. Minerva was Athena. All these different concepts, right? Mars was Ares. And it's just not that simple. It's not. So in a lot of cases, like, yes, the god does essentially represent the same thing. And in a lot of cases, you know, Apollo being the most obvious, Dionysus is another, and Pluto, Hades, is another, where they even have like a lot of the same names, right? Apollo is just the same name. Dionysus, his other name in Greek is Bacchus. That's his Roman name. Pluto is a name in Greek, and it became Hades' Roman name. And so those things lead us to this belief that the Romans just straight copied. And it's not that simple. So, you know, with a lot of those, definitely they were influenced by Greek. You know, the Romans, the certainly the Republic, you know, there's so much more history to this. But the Romans were coming around at a time when the Greeks had just kind of been nearby doing similar things for longer. And, you know, Magna Graeca is Sicily, essentially. Like, a lot of southern Italy was very Greek. It was literally Greek colonies before it was Roman. And so we get these ideas, you know, like, they just had a lot of contact. And so, you know, Rome is developing and figuring out its own mythos, its own religion, and they're just being influenced in some ways. And so they take on some similarities. But it's very similar to the way that we know that say Aphrodite, you know, is coming from the East. You know, the Greek Aphrodite is heavily influenced by Astarte of the Phoenicians, the Canaanites, of Ishtar and Inanna from the Mesopotamians, heavily influenced. That doesn't make Aphrodite not Greek. It just gives her these Eastern influences, right? Same with Dionysus. It's very common because while we often want to think about these people existing in this kind of ancient vacuum where they were just by themselves developing everything all in their own little brilliant minds, like, that's unreasonable, right? It's unrealistic to imagine that. The entire Mediterranean was in contact with one another. They were sailing around. They were, you know, they were trading. They were interacting. You know, the Greeks, ancient Greeks, acknowledged that their alphabet comes from the Phoenician alphabet, right? You know, they're just having all of these interactions all around, and they're just taking on these notions. They're adapting them to their own needs. They're evolving it, all of these things. And the Romans did exactly the same thing. It's just that because of the way the world evolved after and the way Latin took over because of Christianity, like, it just became more common to think that the Romans just, like, stole the Greeks. But it's just not the case. Like, there are a lot of really good examples where the Roman gods, while we might be able to connect them to a Greek god, are just so different. So the best examples are Minerva and Mars, okay? So when you hear those names, if you Google them, you will immediately see Minerva is Athena, Mars is Ares. And it's just not that simple. Like, so yes, Mars is a god of war. He has a lot of similarities with Ares. The Romans adapted some stories. Definitely you can connect him with Ares. There's nothing wrong with doing that. But he is not the same god. The Romans saw him very differently. They worshipped Mars in a way that the Greeks simply did not worship Ares. To the Greeks, Ares was more about the violence, the horror of war, whereas Athena was about working with your mind, the strategizing of war, right? And the Roman Minerva doesn't really have that association at all. She is not a war goddess. They have a goddess of war. Her name is Bellona. She does not have an equivalent in Greek because she is a purely Roman goddess. And so it's just like we get these ideas that they're the same, but that is because of everything that happened in the last 1,000 years, not because of what was going on back then. They were influenced, yes. They took on a lot of the same notions. They adapted them to their own needs, absolutely. But the Greeks did the same thing. They just did it with people further to the east, and it just did not get publicized later with as much, you know, obvious connections to that region. It's really interesting, though, to look at how this has been seen. And I'm really glad you asked, because I know at the beginning of the show, I very much perpetuated the idea that the Romans stole everything from the Greeks. But I think it is just so much more interesting to look at it for what it was, which is just this interaction across the Mediterranean amongst all of these different ancient people who are just adapting and learning and growing and evolving. And they're just doing that in concert with everyone around them, and then all of these influences. Like, there are all these other Roman gods that are explicitly influenced by other groups and ones that were totally invented by Rome, and or they took notions from Greek and they made them so much bigger. Like the Roman Vesta, fascinating goddess, equivalent to the Greek Hestia and yet vastly different. Vesta was seen in a very different light. You know, a lot of similarities and a lot of really major differences. And I just think that is so much more interesting than looking at it as this kind of like stolen thing. So again, thrilled you asked, because I think it's so interesting. I want to have someone on to have a conversation about this, because it's really hard to convey just my talking, because like there's just so much more to it. One of these days I will figure out who is best for that, because I really think it's interesting. Thank you so much for that question. All right, this next one is coming from B, who says, "Hi, so I'm very excited and nervous to share this, but I'm in the process of researching for a novel I'm writing. It's going to be about the story of Heracles, but rewritten as if Heracles was a woman. Basically, my question to you, oh knowledgeable one, is what readings and referencing material would you recommend / suggest as I begin this venture?" Thank you, B. That's so exciting. I love to hear of more and new Greek mythology retellings, especially like unique takes like this. Really interesting. As I was saying earlier, theoi.com is your friend. They are not as good. Like, it's weird. They don't have individual pages for most of the heroes, which is perpetually infuriating, but I get it, because it's like they would just be too extensive. But Heracles is a different one. They do have individual pages for all of his labors and another handful for other things that have been done. Heracles is tricky, you know, because he really, you know, he just spanned so many generations. His stories are so fragmentary because he was just so important that everyone wanted to talk about him. But I think he's a lot like a lot of those other gods, where they were so important that the stories just didn't get put down into like intense detail because they were too busy. Like, these gods and concepts were too busy just being like really important on a day-to-day basis. Look at those websites, look at imagery, because a lot of the times what we know of Heracles' stories comes purely because like a pot would display this thing that we don't even have a source for, but it's on a pot, which is just kind of fun. There's this 2-book set, which is very expensive, I'm sorry, but maybe it's available at a library near you. It is called Early Greek Myths by Timothy Gantz, and it is very academic. It is very dry. It is very much just for sourcing, but it does detail kind of all of the different sources for all the different versions of certain characters. So that would be a good one, too. But honestly, yeah, I mean, it is tricky to research this stuff. It really is. So I don't know, listen to all the episodes I've done. That's helpful too. You can check my sources. They're always in the episode's description. And good luck. That's seriously so fun. The more retellings, the better, if you ask me. All right, next one, and actually quite related, so I'm thrilled to have it next, is from Michelle, who says, "Why haven't you covered Hebe, the goddess of youth? I would love to know more about her." Thank you, Michelle. What a great question. Hebe was married to Heracles once he got deified. But that is almost the only thing we know about her, which is why I haven't talked about her. I'm sorry. Hebe is really interesting. Yes, she is the goddess of youth. She marries Heracles. She is the daughter of Hera and Zeus, one of the few children they explicitly have together versus Zeus having them with everyone else. But there's just not really any stories associated with Hebe. There's just not enough to fill an episode, unfortunately. That's the case of so many gods, and it doesn't make them any less important or interesting. It's just a matter of, like, actual stories. Like, there's lots of references to Hebe. She was all around. She is mentioned a lot. She does not have stories. She does not have a narrative structure for me to give you. And so when it comes to my scripted episodes, there's just nothing I can really do because, like, there just isn't a story. Like, I'm even scrolling through her page on theoi.com, which if you want to learn more, go there. Again, I basically should be just, like, selling theoi.com now, but I just love them so much. But, like, even a lot of the references we have are, like, this is from the Homeric hymn to Hermes, or to Heracles, sorry. It says, Heracles lives happily in the glorious home of snowy Olympus and has neat-ankled Hebe for his wife. And you're like, great. We know Hebe was there. We know she was his wife. That's it. Pindar says, the hero Heracles it was, Alcmene's mighty son, who gave at last to high Olympus, he who, searching out all the far lands of earth and rock-walled stretches of the foaming seas, tempered the rough straits of the for the seamen's sails. Now at the side of Zeus, the aegis-bearer, he dwells, enjoying happiness most fair. Of the immortal gods, a friend held high in honor, lord of the golden halls, husband of Hebe, son-in-law of Hera. Like, Hebe is just this additional piece of Heracles' puzzle, essentially. Like, it is too bad. Like, we have another reference in the Iliad away from Heracles. We've got Hebe washed Ares clean and she put clothing on him. Or, you know, sometimes she's just noted as being standing next to her mother. Like, Pindar says, beside her mother Hera, guardian of marriage, Hebe, fairest of all the goddesses. Like, we know she was pretty. We know she was there. That's it, honestly. It's really too bad. I would love if there was a story for me to tell you, but there just isn't. There's so many gods like that, which is why I love these Q&As, because I know you guys want to hear about them. And if you give me this chance, you give me the name Hebe, then I can go on and I can talk about what little we do know, like this, you know, but I just can't. I can't write 5,000 words about her. I would love to, but they would all be fictionalized, and that's just not what I do here. All right, and we're going to finish this first part of the Q&A episodes with one from Bella. And actually, you know what? Bella had two questions, and I'm going to cover both of them. So the first one from Bella is, I've noticed a lot of times in Greek myth, a singular woman will get agency, while women as a whole don't necessarily get agency. Are there any myths where all the women in the story get some sort of agency? I was going to say no, and then I realized that there are the Danaids. So, like, maybe if you want one, you could maybe make a stretch and say the Danaids, which are the 49 women who killed their 49 cousin husbands. That's not a great example. But no, I would say no, but that is also because mythology doesn't look at agency the way we would look at agency now, right? So the mythology I know I've said this in so many different episodes, so I won't try to harp on it, but I also know not everyone listens to everything, so maybe it's helpful. It's tough for me to say. But basically, we have to remember that Greek myths, like, I would say this does not include the plays, right? The myths themselves were not developed like we develop stories, novels, what have you now. They were not developed with a plot in mind or with character development or with agency, because the purpose was to explain something about the world, something about history, you know, their understanding of history. Their purpose was to explain and just sort of, like, talk about life. It wasn't to develop these, you know, realistic characters with realistic personalities and agency. So it's just sort of irrelevant. Like, you know, I don't want to suggest that this means that the women in the stories had it good. Like, obviously, they didn't. But agency specifically is just sort of irrelevant in mythology. Like, no one really has a lot of agency because it just was not the point. Again, that is different when we're talking about the plays, because the plays were developed with entertainment, with storytelling, with plot in mind. And so I think you could easily say that a lot of the characters and women broadly in plays have a lot of agency. say, I mean, maybe the Phoenician women or the Trojan women might be good examples. Both of those I covered so long ago in the show now that it is hard for me to remember exactly. But it's, you know, those might be good examples. But yeah, in the mythology itself, it's just sort of irrelevant. And that's the thing that interests me most. You know, the fact that these weren't stories written for plot and character, that they were just something else entirely, something that now we in this modern world basically can't understand. We can't understand it in the way that they understood it. It's impossible because we know too much. We have too much broad knowledge of the earth, the planet, science, nature. Like, we just have too much knowledge to understand anything like they would have understood it. And that's interesting in itself. So it's just sort of this unknowable thing. And to me, that's so much more interesting than looking at whether they have agency. That said, in the plays, it is really interesting. Like, Medea is such a great example of having agency and, like, what she does with it, you know? So I think that if you're talking about plays, that's a really interesting question to examine. But in myths broadly, don't worry about it. But again, like, if you want to stretch, look up the Danaids. I did an episode on them ages ago now, but they're pretty wild. All right. And Bella's second question is going to be the last one of this part, and then I will get to more next week. And it is. It just begins, and this is why it is my last question. What is life, Liv? So, of course, as any intellectual woman would do, I made a feminist rage playlist, which got me thinking, what is your favorite female rage Greek mythology moment? First off, Bella, send me your feminist rage playlist, please. Second, I mean, I guess it's just gotta be Medea. Like, I don't condone killing your children. That's the bit that's not good. But her revenge on Jason is, it is female rage. And it is everything I want. I think everything I need right now in my life. So yeah, it's gotta be. It's gotta be Medea. Thank you. Oh my gosh. Thank you all so much for listening. I am really doing my best right now. I know a lot of you, and like, this was in part of a different question. Actually, you know what? I'm going to finish this off with like a little note. Someone named Renee left me a really lovely message about just taking care of myself. I'm assuming this was a reference to a couple months ago when I had COVID. God, it has barely been 2 months. But yeah, thank you. That's really kind. Unfortunately, well, you know, not unfortunately, because basically, you know, the reason why I can still do this podcast and why it is my job, and that is the coolest and greatest thing that's ever happened to me. So I won't say that this is a bad thing, but that does come with responsibility in terms of how much content I put out. So there is only so much kind of resting and keeping to myself that I am allowed to do in order to keep this, you know, as a career in the way that I want it to be, in the way that I love. So it's fine. It just makes it more like a regular job, right? But it does mean I get a lot of lovely messages from you all telling me to take care of myself. And it means the whole world to me. This has been sort of hinted at, and it will be, I think, hinted at in other episodes. I've recorded a bunch of things up front just because I'm going away for a couple of weeks. And I'm going to try to say this without crying, but my cat died. And I know everyone has strong relationships with their pets, and I don't want to try to lessen anyone else's experience. But I had that cat for 16 years and got him when I was 18 and moved out of my mom's house. So I've just sort of never had life without him. Sorry, this is choppy while I pause and allow myself to speak. But anyway, I just wanted to say it because the episodes that I've been recording in advance of, thankfully, I had this trip booked to leave my apartment and I don't have to be in it. And I'm really, really grateful that I am able to travel and escape. It doesn't mean I've had to prepare all of these episodes in advance. So I'm like having to prepare them while also like in deep, unending amounts of grief. And then also like prepare a lot of them quickly, which is why I'm really glad that I have two episodes worth of Q&As to do for you guys. I also struggle so much with like how much me to put on this podcast. I know you all love it and it's part of what's made me me. It's also really hard sometimes because I'm like a really introverted person and it's weird like talking into this microphone and then knowing how many people are going to hear it. But I also know that, you know, the cat was on from episode one. So FYI, and if the next few episodes are weird, you know, give me some grace, because I need to do them. But I'm also trying to do them in a way that, you know, that I can manage at this time. There's also just like so much else that's happened in the past 2 months. It's really impressive, actually, just how many things both directly in my life and peripherally like have exploded all at once. So, yeah. Anyway, this got dark. Thank you all so much for your questions. Like, they really mean a lot to me, and I'm really glad to have them. Not least because it just makes doing this easier at this really hard time. But also, you know, I just really appreciate the questions. I like doing these episodes, you know, at the best of times. I really do, because they open up all these new forms of thought, and they really let me share stuff with you guys that I wouldn't think of otherwise, because I need to hear these prompts from you. I need to have these questions so that I know the stuff that you want to understand more, or that you want broken down for you in different ways. Like, it's really great, and I find it so beneficial and so enjoyable. So thank you so much for your questions. I will get to hopefully the rest of them next week. I probably can't get to all of them, but I'm gonna do my best. And just, yeah, thank you all for listening for however long you have been. I'm recording this right at the end of December, so it's sort of looking into a new year and hopefully a good one. But thank you all, you know, for however long you've listened, for supporting the show, for doing whatever you do, because, you know, like, for all life is shit right now, the fact that this is my job is still the fucking coolest thing that's ever happened to me. And the fact that, you know, I'm in this position where I can travel, where I can, you know, do this for my job and work on other things that I hopefully get to bring to you all soon as well. It's really fucking cool. And I really couldn't do it without you all listening. So thank you. Like, yeah, I'm really bad at being vulnerable, clearly. Made a mess of it in this episode. But thank you all so much for listening and supporting the show and all your kind words in these messages and these questions through my site, and any kind thing anyone has commented on Instagram or emailed me, really just thank you. Like, all of it really means the whole world to me. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, my assistant producer. Laura Smith is the absolutely wonderful production assistant and audio engineer. Select music used in this episode was by Luke Chaos. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, and help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you will get bonus episodes and more. I have not been active on my Patreon for the last month or two between COVID and then literally, like, my childhood best friend died last month, and we, like, did not have a close relationship. It was the most complicated thing in my life, but it was still a blow. And then Lupin and then so much friend stuff. Oh my God, it has been a time. So if you are one of my patrons, I'm sorry for not getting you everything that you all deserve. I hope to be back soon. Jesus. Thank you all so much for listening. I'm excited to feel better soon. When I come back from this trip, hopefully enough time will have passed and I can start being funny and interesting in these episodes again. That's got to be one of the hardest parts about doing a job that you love and are passionate about when you are desperately sad. It's a mess. Thank you all so much for listening. I have got to stop talking now. I am Liv, and I love this shit.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com. That's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
We went from normal life, healthy child to acute lymphoblastic leukemia or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.